Hiya, I'm Sally Hughes, and this is the return of Beyond the Bathroom, where each week I find out how my guests feel about their own appearance. What kind of relationship do they have with their own face and body? What are their go-to products? Are they obsessive about their appearance, or is it low on their list of priorities? And how have time and experience changed how they feel about the way they look? Today's guest is Lorraine Pascal. Lorraine is a TV chef, former model and adoption ambassador who was born in London in 1972. She was the first Black British model to appear on the cover of US Elle and has worked with people like Chanel, Versace and Robbie Williams. After taking a degree in the culinary arts, Lorraine established herself as a pâtissier, making the move to TV in 2011 with Baking Made Easy and Home Cooking Made Easy. She's since presented cookery shows all around the world and has sold almost 1 million books in the UK alone. Lorraine is the patron of the UK's largest adoption and fostering charity and presented her own documentary on the subject in 2014. And if that wasn't enough, during lockdown, she studied for an MSc in psychology. While subsequently studying for a PhD, Lorraine has written and spoken up about the effects of her difficult upbringing, in and out of the care system, and on her sense of self-worth. But how does she use that life experience and training in psychology to deal with the assumptions people make about her based on her past, her work, and her appearance? Welcome, Lorraine Pascal. But before that, a massive thank you to Clinique, who are sponsoring this series of Beyond the Bathroom. Clinique, where great-looking skin begins. I'm so happy to see you. We were just talking, weren't we, that I've been trying to get you on here for ages.
Yeah.
Because I bumped into you in the street on the way to record another episode with Ruby Wax, and you were like, come and have a cup of tea. And I came round to your house for an hour, and I was like, I actually don't want to go. I'd like to just record the podcast here because we were having such a good chat.
Yeah.
So a couple of years later, I've managed to get you in your own right.
Yes.
Welcome. This is something like the third or fourth time I've interviewed you, and it's always such a pleasure. You're a real thinker, I think. You think a lot about the kind of themes that we talk about on this show, and you've even kind of turned it, as I mentioned in the intro, into a career, a passion, and an education. But before all that kind of enlightenment came along, let's just go back to the beginning. So you're roughly my age, I think a year or two older than me.
How old are you?
I am 50 in 2 weeks.
I'm 52.
Yeah, a couple of years.
I'm 53
old.
This year. Yeah.
I want to come back to your 50s because I'm obsessively talking to women in their 50s at the moment about how they're finding it.
Okay, yeah.
So I definitely want to come back to that. In terms of your childhood, so it's been very well documented because you've done so much important work in this area around adoption. You were adopted mm-hmm. very young mm-hmm. and spent some time in foster care with your lovely foster mum, who I believe you're still very much in touch with. And then you were adopted by a white middle-class couple.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where you grew up, and you have a brother, right?
Yes, I was fostered first, then adopted by them. But then I was fostered again when I was 8. They split up when I was 3. My mother had quite bad addiction problems, so I went back into care when I was 8. Yeah.
That's quite a massive thing. I mean, a lot of it is big stuff, big themes. But to go back into foster care because your mum was unwell must have felt really hard, especially at 8 years old.
It was actually a relief, if I'm honest, because she was drinking a lot and not very
did
nice.
Did you feel that sense of chaos?
I mean, it was always chaotic. I think she always said that I was a bit of a mistake. Well, not a bit. She always said I was a mistake and the reason her marriage broke down and everything.
That's tough.
So foster at home, being in foster care was actually a relief. It was actually like, felt great because it was away from home, which was not a good place to be.
Did you feel safer?
I don't know if safe, when you're 8, you think about safe or unsafe. It just felt better, you know. I think that's all it was. It just felt like it was with lots of other people, lots of other children. And then when I was 11, my mother found a charity that actually will fund places in boarding school rather than being in and out of care. It's actually cheaper. So I ended up going to boarding school. I got a full scholarship to go to boarding school at 11. So that was amazing because it was consistent, I think, if I look back. It was consistent. I knew what was coming every day. I had great friends. I loved it.
We've had a couple of guests on over the years who went to boarding school, and it fascinates me. I went to a state comprehensive, and I think people who did sometimes sort of have this kind of weird, almost fetishistic curiosity about that. It just seems so kind of otherworldly to be at boarding school. But for you, you say it was consistent, safe, reliable. What was your experience there overall?
Well, it was just fun. There's lots of sort of activities, and you know, it was brilliant. I mean, we all have different experiences, if you go to boarding school, and yeah, different people that you're with, and different teachers, different areas of the world. So, and who you are as a person, it depends if it suits you or not. Depends on your sort of your genetic makeup, if it works for you. So I loved it. It made me really independent. It made me understand the importance of making your bed in the morning because you had to, or all those kind of things, like doing your own laundry and trying new things. And, you know, with prep, when you do homework, you're in a room with, you have to do your homework because you're not allowed to talk. So you always did your homework. So it was very organized.
And you're a grafter, aren't you? You're quite a diligent person. You get on with your stuff. So it must have stemmed from there as well as your personality
I mean, maybe, but my mother was a real hard worker, my dad as well. So, but again, it's so much in, I think it's a lot to do with your genetic makeup as well.
So your boarding school was an all-girls school, I read.
It was, yeah.
There's something kind of unusual, I think, about that. I mean, there's something unusual about being with people of the same gender all the time anyway, right? It's not how the real world is. And it kind of, it breeds a certain sort of culture. And I was wondering, since I'm so interested in this relationship we have with our appearance, how that came out when surrounded by these girls. Were you pretty, for example? Did you feel pretty? Was there a sense of competition within the school culture about that kind of thing?
You know, there wasn't really. The all-girls school I went to was lots of kids who were from, you know, the army kids, navy kids, some of the forces. So it was very grounded. It wasn't the same, you know, back then there was not the Instagram and the this and the that. It wasn't like that. So I didn't really think about that so much. When it's all girls, it was, for me anyway, it was just more relaxed. At primary school, it was harder because there wasn't representations of me, being black. I was like the only black at school. But secondary school, it was really mixed. So I think it was more relaxed because there weren't boys there, because it wasn't
known to impress, I guess.
For me, I didn't feel I was known to impress. It was just on a Sunday going to church when you walk past the boys' school. That's when you got really made up to go to Sunday school.
Exciting.
Go to church, yeah.
The frisson of walking past the boys' school.
Passing letters to each other without the teachers seeing.
You mentioned primary school and looking different from everybody else. You're also a black woman, or rather a black child being raised by a white family. And you're not in central London that is so much more diverse. I'm interested in the complexities around being a child who doesn't look like their family and the people in their immediate locale.
I mean, I suppose first and foremost, I didn't really know any different. So even though I was looking different, I didn't know. It's not like I was with people who looked like me and then I wasn't. So there was that. And then also my mother was very affirming of my colour. She was very affirming of, you know, your skin's so beautiful, your hair's so beautiful. So from that angle, I was okay. You know, I was really, you know, strangely, one would think it would be really difficult, but she was really affirming. She did it so well.
And how early did that start? Not just affirming of your blackness, but affirming just of you as a beautiful person. How early did that start? When did you first really become aware of your kind of your physical appearance?
I think it's probably about 8. She did it all the way along. So, you know, you're adopted, you're a chosen one, you're a special one. You know, sometimes the words did not match with her actions.
Sure.
but never with the colour or anything like that. She was always very positive. So I think it was about 8 I became aware of, oh, you know, I do look different. And maybe there's something in that when children start to really understand, who knows, their colour identity, I don't know. But even though she'd always mentioned it, I really became quite aware of it around 7 and 8.
And in what way did you become aware of it?
Just like, oh, yeah, look, I can see, you know, literally. Yeah. But before it was kind of like, yeah, I'm black. But, you know, just to see black, white, just for it to... paying attention, I guess.
And did you feel pretty or did you not care either way?
I don't think the word pretty wasn't the word pretty. It was just, it was always being told, you're beautiful, your skin's beautiful, black is, you know, all of that. Black skin is beautiful, black hair is beautiful. It was more like a general understanding to make me feel accepted, I guess. And she understood about black hair, the importance of black hair.
I was going to ask about that because that's something that... people worry about a lot when they have stepchildren, adopted children who have black hair and they don't know what they're doing and how sensitive a thing that is. And so tell me about that. That must have been quite powerful that she knew what she was doing.
Yeah, I mean, she used to live in Jamaica. Yeah, I don't know if that makes any difference, but they did used to live in Jamaica. I think it's not just if you're black and your mum's black or not. I think it's just in general being empowering and affirming to children regardless.
Yeah.
So even if you don't know, you might both be white parents and a kid comes out with super thick curly hair or something. So it's just about being affirming regardless, letting them know they're perfectly imperfect just the way they are, being positive around that appearance, I think, is really important. Obviously, everything else too. But that you know, when you say, you know, the black and the white or the stepchildren thing, I think it's also just in general. Because mm-hmm. it doesn't...
It's such a balance though, isn't it? I'm really interested in this as a subject. And I know, obviously, with your studies in psychology, you'll have some kind of view on it. And also, you're a mum. This thing with children, just how much should you talk about their appearance is a real balance, right? I can't remember my parents ever talking to me about my appearance, which I found to be a really positive thing. They didn't criticise how I looked. They just didn't comment on how I looked. And then I can't remember them ever telling me I was beautiful, but they never criticised me. I felt quite neutral, to be honest, about the whole thing. And sometimes I wonder, I hear people say to their kids, oh, look at you, you're so perfect. And I think, oh, no, stop drawing attention. And I wondered if there's like when you, with your daughter and in your studies, if you feel there's a kind of perfect clutch biting point, I suppose, where you're affirming without obsessing.
I think it's impossible to say.
Right.
I think I'm sure I've made many errors with my daughter. And I think it depends so much on like your natural, your biology, you know, who you are as a person, your own personality. It depends on where you're growing up. It depends on who you have around you. There's so many factors to consider as to what is the right balance. So it's probably impossible to get it right, you know, but it's just to do your best. You know, my mother never said anything about my body ever at all. Or never.
I do think that's powerful for a mother not to do that.
Nothing about fat, thin, nothing. I never heard any of those words. You know,
I think that's quite a big deal that when mums don't do that. And of course, it's really hard for mums not to do that because mums aren't living in a bubble either. They're constantly being told by the world that they're too fat, too thin. And so it's a big deal to have to kind of cut that off and not pass it on to your daughter. But when it happens, I think it's pretty powerful.
It is quite an impossible task.
It really
is. To get it right. And I just think there's so many studies that say so many different things, but then there's so many studies that say other things.
Yeah.
And then somebody, you'll see someone on Instagram that says, do this because this is what you have to do. Otherwise, if you don't, your children will be like this. And then someone else says, no, if you do this. So I think it's important to do what you feel is the right thing.
So you were an academic child. You'd got the scholarship.
I wasn't an academic.
But you're diligent, aren't you?
I have to work really, really hard. Like, my daughter's super smart. she works really hard, but she's super smart. Like she's that
instinctively part,
yeah,
smart.
She doesn't. Me, I worked really, really hard, and I didn't get really top grades. She works really, really hard, and she does get top grades. So I'm not. Yeah, I have to work really hard, but I enjoy it. I enjoy learning. I enjoy education.
And so if you were quite focused on your studies and fairly kind of, you know, not feeling any pressure to look a certain way at school, it's quite a big leap then to become a model in terms of suddenly everybody's talking about how you look, often very negatively. Mm-hmm. And so did you have any sense before becoming a model that that might be a job you could do?
No, not really. I just...
So how did it come about?
I kind of fell into it. Somebody mentioned it and I thought, oh, that would be interesting. And then... I met Beth Bolt.
Yeah.
She had actually found Naomi. And then I met her and she said, oh, come to London. So I thought, okay, great. I went to London. She said, unfortunately, I can't take you on. So I was like, okay, fine. And then she gave me the list of all the model agencies in the Association of Model Agencies. And I went to every single one on the list. I came up on the Oxford Tube, you know, that bus from Oxford. I saved up all summer to come up. Went to all the agencies. They all said no. There was one left on the list. I even went to a page 3 one. I didn't know. I know that doesn't exist anymore, does it, page 3? But, you know, like a boobie one.
Yeah. A glamour modelling agency.
Glamour model one. Yeah. Which, you know, it's nothing wrong with it. It's not for me.
Yeah, sure.
The last one on the list said, yes, we'll take you on. Because I rang them from a payphone, like from the King's Road, and they were in Covent Garden. I said, oh, I know you're probably closed, but... I've come for luck from Oxford and I really want you to see me. He said, yeah, come by. He took me on.
It's it's interesting with modelling. I was talking to a good friend of mine the other day who was a successful model in the noughties. And she was saying that she thinks that she was insulted so much about her appearance for so long that if anything... she has less of her self-esteem invested in her looks because she couldn't afford to be upset by not looking right because people constantly told her she looked wrong.
It does toughen you up.
So tell me about that. What would the kind of level of rejection be on a daily basis?
Back then, as we know, back then, being 52, being Gen Xers, the level of inappropriateness.
I mean, yeah.
It's off the scale.
Was it even a Tuesday if you weren't sexually harassed?
You weren't sexually harassed or something racial thrown at you or something, yeah. So they'd say, am I going to do the X show or whatever show? No, they're not using black people this year, you know, or...
To your face, just...
Oh, yeah.
Not to your agent, to your face.
To your face, to your agent, or you're a bit too black, or already got one black model.
Nice.
You know... all of that stuff. Or, you know, you're too this, your boobs are too big, your face is too this, your bum's too that. Yeah. Your daily. You get used to it. So it doesn't mean it's okay.
So how old are you at this point when you start?
16, 17.
So 16, 17 is when most girls are probably at their least confident, arguably at their most beautiful, but also arguably at their least confident. But this what, bounces off you or it's upsetting and then it's not? What's your process?
I don't think I remember it being upsetting. I think I just thought, because they go, you know, well, Lorraine, you know, we're using what represents the population, you know.
Wow.
So, you know, you're not going to work in Germany because they really only like blondes because that's how that represents it. So I was like, okay, yeah, it makes sense. I kind of just went with it. You know, there's only not so many black people. Okay, got it. It's not great because I'd like to earn more money, but okay, I got it. I understand.
And within that, I suppose, another kind of racism, a sort of colourism thing where you're too black or not black enough.
Too black, not black enough, hair too curly, hair too, oh, yeah. Maybe, you know, your friend was right. You just like, okay, whatever then.
You just can't afford to let it break.
But you could get rejected 10 times in a day.
Yeah.
So, I mean, 10 times a day, 5 days a week.
I mean, it's a lot of rejection.
Yeah.
Given that most 16-year-olds, you know, take to their bed for a week when a boy says one mean thing, because everything is so heightened when you're that age.
Yeah.
To be working and to be constantly face-to-face with people going, you're too tall, you're too short, you're too black, you're not black enough, you're too fat, you're too thin, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Is a lot.
She's not up enough, you know, she's not exciting enough, she's not, you know, she's not smiling enough, she smiles too much. I think it becomes, I think what it became, I mean, now it's all different with everyone. You can get all surgery, so much different surgery, but it's like, I can't do anything else. This is who I am.
Yeah.
So
yes,
I can't do it.
What I look like.
It's not like maybe if I was acting or something, oh no, I have to try and do better. It's like, well, this is it.
Yeah.
I'm 5'10 and a half. So.
Yeah, I can't hunch
for long. If I'm too tall, then. This is my size today. So you're going to have to deal with it or go with someone else.
Were you ever tried to be pushed into changing? I saw an interview with you when I was doing my research. And I mean, it was quite a tongue-in-cheek comment, but I noticed it of you saying, well, I was always bloody hungry.
Yeah.
I was a model. Were you having to be aware?
Because back then, if you remember, in the kind of naughty, in the sort of late, in the 90s, models were more like a size 6, 8, 10, not even 6. It was more like 8, 10.
I, years ago, interviewed one of the British Vogue supermodels from the cover. I won't say who it was, but she said to me when she started, she'd just done a catwalk comeback not that long ago, and she said she was shocked because they'd had to make the clothes specially for her because she was two sizes bigger than all the clothes, even though she's the same size as she was when she was a supermodel. And she said the samples were always a 10. She said, I always wore a 10. I was like a generous 10. And now there are 4 or 6. And so they had to make clothes.
Less.
Yeah.
4 or 6, that's pushing it. You know, nowadays it's...
She couldn't get into them, even though she was exactly the same. And so the aesthetics of top models has definitely changed. They've definitely got thinner. So was there ever any pressure on you to keep down the calories, keep down the poundage?
During Fashion Week, you know, it was, you know, maybe I wouldn't have Kentucky. Or a chicken. But it was like that, you know, 16, size 10, this was fine. So it was not how it is today, like the 00. So I haven't been a 00 since I was like 3 years old, I don't think.
I mean, I don't even know what that looks like, a 00.
So
can't really picture
that. I'd have to sort of remove like bones.
Yeah.
So it's sort of drill, shave off bones. I can't. So it's not going to happen. So I can't be that size. So did I feel immense pressure? Not so much. And I think it is what, like you're saying, it was size 8, size 10, which is kind of what I was anyway. So.
And you were young. So your metabolism was probably raging.
Yeah. Metabolism, super fast.
Yeah. So you talk about that kind of overt racism, there's no other way to slice it, of people saying, well, we've already got a black girl this year or whatever it is. But also, it was a time where, whether it was spoken or not, you didn't really see kind of campaigns and magazine covers so much. I know you were the first black woman on the cover of USL ever, which is mad because I still think of you, maybe because of my age, as quite a recent model. It's quite shocking to me that you were the first because...
Oh, black British model.
Yeah.
Black British. Yeah.
It's quite shocking to me because it feels like that was the other day. And it's amazing how much has happened just in a few decades.
It's happened. It's really changed.
And so how was it on the front line there trying to get work and campaigns? Give us a sense of what there was out there for a black model, however successful.
One of the things to remember is as well, again, in the non-Instagram world, you didn't see so much of what you weren't doing.
Interesting. Tell me about that.
So now, if you don't go to a party or if you don't get a campaign, or you will see it because it's all over Instagram, it's all over social media.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there'd be a small handful of campaigns and you might not get one of them, but I wouldn't know of the sort of 300 other things going on. So it literally, and probably not in a positive way, but you literally become kind of resigned to the fact that you are not going to work as much as a white model, and that's that. So it's kind of like, and I did become, which again, maybe it's not a good way of being, it's like, I know what this industry is. I know what they do. I know what's on offer. I can take it or leave it. You know, I'm not going to change it. I can't go walking in with a banner and start protesting and tell them it's not going to make any difference. So I know this is my choice to be in this industry and to understand that, unfortunately, it's pretty racist and I'm not going to work as much as my white friends, but... you know.
When was the first time you had a sense that something might be shifting, albeit, let's be honest, at snail's pace, even though it feels like 5 minutes ago, not enough has changed, but some has changed. Was there a moment where you started to feel like, oh, I don't know if I'd have got that job a couple of years ago?
I mean, I think since Edward Enfield, when he became editor of Vogue, I think that's when the tide changed.
It was a big moment.
It was a big moment, and it has made such incredible changes with his work for representation of all people. And so I really think that I wasn't really working then. Then, but I think that's really when I've seen
you
a real
had worked
change.
Together on ID and the like, hadn't
we've
you?
Worked together on ID and other things, but I think that's when the real change. Now it's just the norm to see different coloured faces on ads, different coloured faces on ads, black people, Indian people, and it's so wonderful. But it wasn't a given before. But he changed the game.
It was a very big moment. I think that was felt throughout fashion and beauty. It felt like a stake in the ground.
It's just so lovely to see someone with the same colour as me.
Right.
You know, it's just...
in such a powerful position.
Yeah, or no, even just on magazines, and to see, you know, someone my colour or darker even. It's like so amazing, because it just didn't happen. It's even wearing my hair like in braids, even though they need to be changed because they're so old. But even when wearing my hair in braids, I remember when I did... like in the 90s, people were like, oh, what's this? What's going on? You know, like getting like it's some kind of Attenborough, you know, creature on my head. And it used to make me not very confident to wear it. But now it's just normal.
Did people in fashion want you to have relaxed, straight hair?
No, they wanted me to cut my hair off back then, which is fine because I just shaved it all off. It's easier. I had a like number one buzz cut.
Why is that? Do you think it was just because they wanted to make life easy for themselves on shoots? Or
no, I think it did.
Because Alec Wackers was a big thing? Or
well, it was, no, I was before Alec. So I think it was Andrew Jose. I went to see him and he suggested we try it, and I went with it and it was great.
I mean, it did look beautiful on you.
And then you don't have to do hair and makeup for ages, and you can go to the shows late because you don't have hair. Yeah.
How did you feel about having short hair? I was asking a guest the other day about her short hair. I have never had short hair, so I'm always really intrigued by women who do this. I mean, I would not look good with short hair.
You don't think?
No.
I think it would suit you.
That's very sweet of you to say. I just don't...
Why don't you like short hair? For you?
For me?
Yeah.
I think I've got a funny shaped head, you know, Lorraine. But you looked so beautiful with short hair. Did you feel powerful without having to worry about it? This is the thing I envy when I see women with very short hair. I think it just looks so free.
I don't know. I think I look scary.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I thought you looked so beautiful.
Well, people said, oh, you look so aggressive sometimes, you know.
Oh.
You're like, okay, well, one person's aggressive as another person's assertive. You know, it's all subjective.
I thought you looked beautiful. I suppose the thing that scares lots of women about short hair is there's nowhere to hide. It's just your face, right? There is nothing to hide behind. There's no armour. You are just saying, this is my face.
Yeah.
Obviously, it helps if you have your face. But I think that...
Oh, thank you.
I just thought you looked so... I thought you looked so beautiful. In my head, I suppose everyone just has a picture of someone in their mind. And my picture of Lorraine Pascal is with no hair. Because I just remember it was such a gorgeous look.
Well, it's funny because my hair now is like down to my waist. Mm-hmm. And it's always up. It's always up and off my face.
Yeah.
So it just feels more comfortable that way.
Quite subversive, I think, for a woman to have really short hair. Quite kind of radical.
Yeah, I don't really want short hair anymore.
Anymore. Well, we go through phases, don't we?
So I had it for so long.
Yeah.
And I'm not for me, I think the wigs look stunning. Wigs look stunning. But for me, at the moment anyway, I'm not there.
I mean, wigs are better than they were.
I'm just lazy because this took me like 3 seconds. You know, if there's hair, it's like a full-time effort, a lot of effort. I prefer to do the effort in the salon once every 6 to 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's it.
I think as well as people like Edward, who are obviously so influential, I think Pat has been a big influence.
Mm-hmm. Love Pat.
I mean, she's obviously, I mean, arguably the best makeup artist in the world. Also a black woman. I feel like something has changed in beauty professionals. I feel like beauty professionals know what they're doing with different skin tones in a way that they didn't.
Yeah, it's a bit of a drama in the old days. They'd be like fashion fair. Remember fashion fair?
Yeah. Still in America, isn't it, fashion fair?
Fashion fair. And the counter would always be like an absolute mess in the
Yeah, the neglected counters.
Half of it would be gone.
I still think fashion fair have some good products, you know. Fashion fair, for anyone listening who's younger than us,
yeah,
was a brand for black customers.
Yeah.
There was Iman.
But back then, Fashion Fair did save me because it was the only brand around.
Yeah, totally.
However, it was very red. But
it was
now they are very good.
Yeah, I think so.
So I haven't used it for ages. But yeah, they are very good. But before it was red, but it still was the only one that I could find. So
yes,
thank you, Fashion Fair.
The bases had a very red undertone.
They did.
But still better than an American Tan Dream Matte Mousse, which is like the other thing that was on offer.
Because I'm more kind of yellowy. I'm not red. I'm golden. You know,
yes,
you do the thing.
Yes, you I'm don't not have red undertone.
But listen, if that's all on offer, I would take it, which I did. There was Barry M, but that was the lipstick. Do you remember Barry M?
I love Barry M. Barry M's still going.
Yeah. I love Barry M.
British company. Love Barry M.
Yeah, there was Iman, and there was a green one. I can't remember what it was because Iman came later, and everyone started having a go.
Yeah.
But now, like going to Boots, go to Boots on High Street, Cairn. And it's amazing, it's not regular Boots because it's on High Street Cairn, but it's quite big. But to see just all the different colours is amazing.
Yeah.
It's very affirming. It feels nice. It's like a sigh. I can go in and choose all the different ones. I love Huda.
Yes.
I love Lancome.
Yeah, totally. I mean, now you really notice it when people...
Florrie Roberts.
Yeah.
It just came to me.
Yeah.
So that was the green one.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was another one. Yeah. And I love the names. Coco, espresso.
Yeah.
You know, they're all like nutmeg.
There's a move away from that now. You can't.
Is there?
Well, yeah. Conversations are had now about the appropriateness or lack thereof of naming deeper tones after food. And paler tones after things like a beige and nude, and then deeper tones after food is a bit weird.
Chocolate truffle.
I mean, it's arguably better if all the shades are named after something like that. But when there's a clear division,
cinnamon truffle. Those are my foundations.
Cappuccino.
We're not there yet. I don't mind. It makes me laugh.
What about leaving modelling? You were a new mum, I think, when you started to think, I'm not sure this is the life I want.
It was the tail end of modelling. I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. And I was living in New York, so I wanted to be with my husband, my then husband, and my baby in London. So I left New York and left the catwalk behind.
So you gave up on modelling before it gave up on you. I'm not sure it would now, but at that, because we see lots of models work have really long careers now in a way that we didn't.
I became a bit fed up with it. I think certain people in the industry were quite destructive.
Well, how do you mean?
Certain models were quite destructive of other black models.
Say more about that. How do you mean?
Because it was normally only one black model. Certain black models didn't want other black models to work.
So I've heard this before. You're not the first model to say that to me.
Because it's true.
Do you think that people were made to feel, look, there's only one seat at the table? To your point earlier about people saying to you, well, we've done a black girl this year, we're not doing one this year.
I mean, when I look at it from a sort of 360, yes. So there's all sorts of things. Again, as I say, personality is going to have something to do with it. The personality, the character, the biology, their situation, then society, the systems around us.
Yeah.
Which means that, yeah, sure, you can only have one, which is true. You can only have one. So if you are that one, maybe you're going to fight to the death to keep your place.
It's an internalised racism, isn't it? It's an internalising thing that society is making you feel about yourself and turning it on others.
Yeah, I think it's a lot to do with it. It's always important to look at the systems. It's always easy to look at the person,
absolutely,
but it's really important to look at the system around. And you've got the system of how the the world was then, and then you've also got how the fashion world was then. So there were lots of factors contributing to behaviours like that.
And also some people can be a bit of a cow on top of all that. That's
a lovely way of putting it, Sally. That's a very lovely word for it.
So, people are who they are, right? There is a system against them. There is trauma against them. There is a background. There are negative experiences around them. All of that, but lots of things can be true at the same time, right?
Yeah, some could argue that they're just not nice.
Yeah.
They could.
You were aware that there was kind of only room.
We're all aware of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're all aware of it. But some people may have used that knowledge to make space for other people at the table.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know.
Do you think you would have done that? Had you been?
I don't know. So I can't be a hypocrite and say, oh, I would have made sure. I don't know.
I just don't know.
You know, if you're making all this money and things are going right and there's someone that might take that chunk of money, maybe, who knows? I can't say.
You're pretty pro-women.
I haven't got a halo, that's for sure. So no, I don't
you're
know.
You're quite a pro-woman person, I think, aren't you? I think you would have hiked people up with you. And so did you feel like, look, the way this structure exists at the moment, the way this industry works at the moment, there's a glass ceiling for me, because there will only ever be one queen or one person who looks a bit like me to get.
No, it was, I could have broken through the glass ceiling. It's just a fight I didn't want to fight.
Right.
It's not worth it. You know what I mean? It wasn't worth it for me. I'd rather put my energy somewhere else.
So where you put your energy for a few years was in raising a daughter.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. Your experiences of having been in foster care, having been adopted, and now you have this little girl. Mm. What did you want to instill in her, and what do you hope you instilled in her?
I'm sure she'll tell you.
Of course she will. Of course she will. That's their job.
Definitely not Mother of the Year, that's for sure. I don't know if I had like a plan. I just wanted to make sure that she felt loved, I suppose. Just felt loved and accepted. Yeah.
She has gone on. So your daughter Ella has gone on to be in the public eye herself. She's very beautiful young woman, talented, smart woman, but she's in the public eye, which is one of the most critical places for a young woman to be. Mm. What are your feelings around that? And I suppose, what are her feelings around that?
She's very resilient. She's grown up around it and around people. So she has a lot of support and she knows kind of how it all works. And she's DJing now, so she's doing super well. So it's just like, she's doing this acting and she's doing DJing and being successful in that field. So she's just really inspiring.
We'll dive back in shortly after a quick thank you to our series sponsor, Clinique. Clinique's innovative clinical reality diagnostic tool determines your skin type and tells you which products in their iconic and trusted three-step routine are for you. I've done this myself and it is fascinating. The tool will also identify specific needs. In my case, dullness, dehydration and dark spots, and select the makeup products that work with your skin type, not against it. Clinique skincare and makeup products are dermatologist tested, allergy tested, and 100% fragrance free. Discover your best skin at Clinique, where great looking skin begins. Can I talk to you about COVID?
Yeah.
So during COVID, a lot of us went a bit mad.
Yeah.
Rather than let your psychology destroy you, you decided, you uncovered this passion for learning more.
Yeah. Well, I just was a bit bored, of course.
Sure. And stranded.
Along with everyone.
Yeah, and stranded.
And stranded. So I thought, you know what? What can I do online for a degree? And I found a British Psychological Society degree, accredited degree in psychology. And I did that online. So that was a year. I loved it because it was so busy. I was busy doing essays. And
so this is what you did throughout lockdown. You're thrashing away essays.
Thrashing away about Freud and Jung and, yeah, busy me. But it was a way of distracting myself
sure.
from this terrible situation.
And I suppose it's kind of getting behind the problem, isn't it? When we're all feeling so confused and at sea, just trying to have an understanding of why we feel the way we feel in life.
Yeah, it
gives you a bit of power. Maybe.
I don't even, because I've had so much therapy, it was more just learning about about psychology rather than anything to do with what's about me, if
yeah.
that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I did that, and then I did a counselling certificate diploma that you need. Mm-hmm. And I've done lots of work with foster children. I've done lots of talks in prisons and maximum security women's prisons around relationships and coercive control and abusive relationships, that kind of thing. And so that experience coupled with the counselling certificate I did, then I applied for the doctorate in counselling psychology and psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. So it's a DC psych degree.
So you're working towards the PhD right now?
Yeah, I mean,
that's
so a PhD is one kind of where you go off on your own.
Yes.
And I mean, and then you kind of, but this doctorate, which is a PhD, but it's a taught doctorate, which means you have lessons, you know, you are actually taught as well as doing a thesis, mm-hmm. as well as doing placement hours. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's a lot, but I'm loving it.
You mentioned therapy, and I know you've talked a lot about therapy in the past. You're somebody who is well therapized. You've had lots of therapy in your life. It's been important to you. What has it meant to you, and what has it taught you about your self-image?
I think I haven't really done, it's all been stuff about inside, like
yeah.
self sort of concept, and about learning how the things that happened, how can I put this? I think it's about understanding what's happened, really getting in touch with your emotions, and processing or metabolizing those emotions. So different situations, negative things, and understanding different people's points of view. So it's like a massive process. I mean, I'm 52, been in therapy since when I was in foster care, I saw social workers. So they talk to you, kind of trying to do stuff, but I didn't really talk back because when you're 8, you're not really interested. Well, I wasn't interested.
Yeah.
I can't talk for the 8-year-old.
I mean, it's also quite daunting for a child.
And then, well, she used to take me to the bakery and then she'd always give me an ice bun after the session. I just wanted my ice bun.
I mean, that's interesting that you ended up baking, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, that's from actually primary school when I was 5 because I used to love cooking. Once a year we'd do cooking, and that came from that. But yeah, I think that psychology and therapy, my personal therapy, has helped me accept myself. To see what in life is of my doing and what may be of other people's doing. It's helped me to put up with less shit from people. It's helped me to be much more independent. It's helped me understand my triggers. So I think there's this kind of thing about this amazing healing, which it is. It is a very healing process, but it's a lot about understanding. So do I still get triggered? Of course. Do I still get annoyed? Of course. But now I'm much more aware of where my emotional soft pain points are. And I know when I choose to respond now rather than react from them.
Well, this makes me think of social media, right? Because during COVID, we were obviously all on social media a lot more. You're studying psychology and you're posting a bit about that kind of work, you know, fun sort of videos, the way everybody is. And social media is an odd one, isn't it? Because you're kind of broadcasting, and some people, for whatever reason, are saying things back that are hurtful. But unlike real life, where if somebody walked up to you in the street and said something horrible, that would be bizarre behaviour. There's a sort of degree of societal acceptance over people jumping on a social media feed and being horrible to you. Is that able, like in modelling days, to kind of bounce off you? Or does it ever bounce off anybody, really? I'm not convinced.
I'm not sure.
Does.
I'm going to speak for myself. I'm just like,
please.
What part of you thinks that I care about what you just said to me?
So do you not care?
Not really. Because it's just, it's easy to say something. It's easy to be a keyboard warrior. Once there was some stuff in the media about me, and then I said something on their then Twitter. And then the newspapers picked it up and said I was going on a rant.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh my God, I'm joking. So I'm not going to do that again. So of course things hurt. Of course things hurt sometimes. But it's about, well, what's going on within you to say that to me?
Absolutely.
I think it's a lot more about, you know, first it's always like, okay, is there any truth in it? I always look. It's not always saying it's you. I always look, is there any truth in what they've just said? Is there anything in it? And that's, I guess, where therapy comes in. Because I know myself a lot better and I know this, that and the other, so I can self-reflect, okay, fine. And then I'm like, wow, what must be going on within you to say that? And that's for them to deal with.
And are you able to find compassion?
Absolutely. Compassion forms a lot of my work I've done on myself, a lot of work I do. It's about finding that compassion. There must be something going on. Something's happening within.
But this is your idea of fun.
To say that, it's like, wow, yeah. Yeah.
Sometimes I just think there's only, even if you know what's being said is completely untrue or crazy or coming from a place of unhappiness, sometimes I just think there's only so much aggression you can absorb from somebody else and you just have to kind of step away because it's sort of a bit rattling.
I just give it back a lot of the time.
Do you? So yeah. Is that your response? You don't ignore, you come
in
back?
In a gentle way. But I don't want that their shit in my pocket. You know, if you're giving me, you've obviously got something going on and I don't want to carry it, so you can just have it back.
Yeah.
So I think that's the beauty of being 52 as well.
Yeah.
Like, it's talking about the age thing. I think we're doing a disservice to the younger generations about being older because it's like so much better than what we see in the media. And this, the whole menopause madness. Not that menopause is mad, but yeah. The whole like over banging on about like, but what about all the other good stuff?
Yeah.
There's so much good stuff. It far outweighs menopause symptoms and all of that. Like there's so much good stuff. The confidence you feel within yourself when you get older, for example, like getting comments now at 52, as opposed to when I was, I don't know, even 30 something. It's like I care less. And I know a lot of my friends of my age, you just care less. Because it's like, I'm 52 now. How long am I going to keep worrying about dodgy comments on Instagram?
Right. Time's ticking.
Time's ticking away.
Yeah.
So I think it's like, I think there needs to be a lot more positive messages in tandem with the messages about hormones. But there needs to be a lot more positive messages. Like, it's so good. I'm so happy that I am not, you know, that I'm this age. There's so many benefits.
So I am too. I really like it. The number of people who've said to me recently, how are you feeling? You're about to turn 50, as though I might burst into tears potentially. I don't feel that way at all. So it doesn't sound like you felt that way when you were about to turn 50.
No, and I probably get shot down in flames for saying this. but like the talk about the menopause, like it is the end of the world, right? It's the end of the world. We're talking about how bad it is. But, you know, having blood coming out of yourself every month
fabulous.
From the age of bloody 16 is not like rainbows and sunshine either. Right. So it's just like, and you know, feeling bad and grumpy and teary, and then every single month. So I just think we need to put it into perspective, the menopause. That's what I'm saying. I know everyone's experiences is different, but no one's sort of saying like, okay, but there's a lot of other things. Trauma, symptoms of complex post-traumatic stress disorder are very similar to some, obviously not some of the symptoms, to the menopause. Being a black person as well, I've talked my own experience, or having traumatic childhoods, if you've had a lot of shit growing up and the things you have to deal with, you know, like feeling invisible, feeling all of this, that's a lot of people's experience anyway.
Yes, it is. But also, because this debate is raging at the moment, and I think lots of people will be really happy to hear you say, I cannot take any more negativity about the menopause or imply it.
I don't want to do a menopause. But do you want to do a podcast on menopause? I don't want to do it on menopause. Don't want to do it on menstruation.
Right.
Don't want to do it on anything coming out.
So I think I've got mixed feelings about it. I don't really, sometimes it strikes a chord with me, sometimes it doesn't. I don't know. But I do feel that there is a degree of overcorrection at the moment where nobody talked about the menopause for so long that now I just feel suffocated by a barrage of negativity about it, which is some people's experience. But because no one talked about it for ages, I now feel the negativity is so daunting that I get slightly scared about what's coming for me. And I sort of think of it with dread because all I hear is dread around it. And so for everybody who's positive about it and goes, I'm actually feeling great about it, that makes me and my friends feel good and feel less. It's a little bit like childbirth, right? I get a bit stressed by all the negative experiences of childbirth, and which is why I always make a point of saying to pregnant people, I had two brilliant labours. I really enjoyed giving birth. And it's the
same
truth. It's the absolute truth.
Same.
I really enjoyed it. And I feel that nobody shares their positive birth stories.
Yeah.
And as a result, lots of young women are terrified of having babies.
Terrified of having babies, terrified of menopause. Like,
lots of women in their 40s are terrified of menopause because they don't hear enough people like you going, I feel really great to be 52.
I think it's putting into perspective, when I was looking at the differences between complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is trauma, sustained trauma, rather than PTSD, which is one incident. Complex post-traumatic stress disorder is sustained, you know, childhood full of trauma, right, when it's repeated. Now, obviously, symptoms of the menopause, you've got things that are obviously to do with the menopause. But there's a lot of things like foggy brain, forgetting, anxiety, all of this. It's like, but that's what I've had all of my life anyway from trauma.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, I think we just need to not minimize anyone's experience.
Yeah.
Everyone's experience is different. But I'm telling you, most people, a lot of people have been through a lot of stuff that's a lot harder than what people are making out is the only experience of menopause.
Yeah. I suppose for me, I want to hear about people's very challenging experiences of menopause, but I also want to hear as many of people's positive experiences of menopause.
Why aren't we hearing all stories about like periods as well? Like, why isn't that for people who, why isn't, I don't want to hear it. But I don't either, but it's like, what is happening? What is happening? Also, there's not enough stuff about, I think before, because doctors didn't know so much, but now there's so much out there that most people are going to be okay because you go, you'll get your hormones, you get them tested, you get them retested, you'll take if you can, because I know some people can't take, but then there's other remedies as well, some that work, but there's so much information out there that it's not going to be this horror story that perhaps some people were talking about before people knew. So
I think it's the fear factor. I think this is what worries me. Like my point about childbirth, I just worry that loads of women are scared because of the amount of negativity around it.
I guess it's like looking at everything. There's always a spectrum, right? There's always people that have 10 out of 10 horrendous.
Yes.
And then people that have actually absolutely zero.
And most people are somewhere
in the middle. And at the moment, all the focus is on 10 out of 10. And that's not possible because you might be 0 out of 10. You might be in the middle. You know, but the good thing now is for the spectrum, for the most part, lots of people, I know some people can't, but there's a choice of taking stuff to help.
Yeah.
You know, I know I met this, I think they were French, and they said to me in when she went to a doctor, the doctor gave her antidepressants because when she went through menopause, because, you know, you get depressed, anxiety, that's that, gave her a bit of testosterone and then the estrogen and progesterone. And that was pretty much all. She said that was all wrapped up.
Love a bit of testosterone gel. I've got testosterone gel. Do you? It's so
good. I haven't got it, no.
No, it's good. I only recently started taking it. It's good. I know that one of the ways that you manage your mental health and maybe menopausal symptoms, I don't know, is working out a lot. Mm-hmm. You're really health conscious. You love burning your energy when you wake up in the morning. Tell me about that and what that does for you.
Love going to the gym because I love lifting weights. I've loved lifting weights for about 15 years. So I just love getting up, lifting weights, getting my bones strong, getting my muscles strong. Yeah, have my headphones on, not talking to anyone.
That's so good, not talking to anyone, isn't it? And just coming out and you've just been yourself.
It's like, oh, you're so inapproachable. It's like, maybe it's for a reason.
What, I people think you're unapproachable?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't think that. tell me about meditation. That forms part of the same thing.
Do you know what? I haven't done it for a while now. What? I've done meditation for a while.
When would you deploy it and why?
I was doing transcendental meditation every morning for like an hour. But then over lockdown, I stopped. I don't know why.
Maybe it had just done its job for a bit. I
went a bit mad over lockdown. So I was doing the studying.
I mean, everyone went mad.
And then it was
mad.
That balmy summer. Yeah. And it was like rosé.
Really beautiful.
Wasn't it?
Yeah.
The weather.
I mean, it was like 4 o'clock and you'd be like, well, should we open a bottle? It's so sunny. Yeah. Sit in the garden.
So, yeah, I stopped. So I'm not doing all that kind of as much as I was.
Rosé meditation.
But I've just started doing ice baths. And saunas, which I do like.
And what does that do for you?
Sounds facetious, but I love how warm I get in the sauna when it's so cold outside.
Do you love being hot?
I love it. So going to the sauna, 15 minutes, lie back, it's like being on a holiday, then into the ice bath for 3 minutes, and then back in the sauna.
Do you scream?
No, because everyone's like around.
Quite hardy, so British. Like,
yeah, I did it in Portugal once and I screamed and this guy looked at me like, you're disgusting. So I was like, sorry. But now, no, I'm much better. I can go in. Then I go back into the ice, back into the sauna if it's nighttime, because then you sleep better. But if it's daytime, I tend to just go in the ice bath and that's it, finished. But I get very dizzy sometimes.
Yeah.
So you just have to be really slow. It's like, you kind of like this kind of...
Yeah, I'm definitely dizzier in my
old age. My husband's like, just
lean
into it. Just close your eyes.
I've got really low blood pressure though, do you?
Same. Yeah. Postural hypotension.
Yeah, I've got really low blood pressure. So I quite often have to do that when I stand up.
Same. I fainted the other day.
I'm a fainter.
Oh, you have never fainted before.
It's a blood pressure thing. If you're...
First time.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So normally I get the, you know, fine, but it's so standard.
Yeah.
But I went to kiss my husband and I just went straight past. He thought I was joking.
Did you hurt yourself as you fell?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's happened to me too.
But the door was there. So then he sort of thought, oh, she's not joking, kind of caught me. But yeah, I do get...
Were you frightened or was it fine?
I went straight to the doctor and he said, oh, your blood pressure is really, really low.
Yeah.
So then I felt okay.
But most doctors will say to you, it's better than the alternative.
Special alternative, and I've started to drink.
Low is better
more
than high.
I've had more salt, I have my electrolytes. Now I have salt on my margarita where I didn't before.
A health drink then. A veritable health drink.
And what else did he say I was low in? Something else. I can't remember.
Lastly, can I just ask you about your wedding? So for anyone who doesn't follow Lorraine on social, which they absolutely should, you may have missed Lorraine's second wedding. So you've been married twice, like me. Divorced, remarried. There is something about second weddings of women in their middle age.
Yeah.
You looked so beautiful. I think you were just one of the most beautiful brides I have ever seen. You just looked stunning.
Oh, thank you.
They were breathtaking, those photos. How did you approach the second wedding? Did you just think, I'm having what I want, I'm not doing it for anyone else? Because I think this is what happened.
Oh, I thought, I'm having what I want, I'm inviting everybody. And then Boris said, you can't. And I had to uninvite everyone.
You did not.
Yeah, and we had to have another wedding after.
So did you have a super tiny wedding? First?
Yeah, and then everyone's like, people get angry and they don't speak to you because it's like you can never do anything.
Yeah.
We had to uninvite like 100 people.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So we had a small wedding first.
Yeah.
Which was supposed to be big. And we weren't supposed to have two, but we had a small wedding first.
Yeah.
And it was magical because it was at the registry office on King's Road.
Yeah, an iconic registry office.
Iconic, even though you can only fit like three people inside.
Yeah, it's an iconic venue though, isn't it? Mick and Bianca's that one.
Oh, was it?
There's the two iconic ones are Marylebone and King's Road. All the celebrities got married there. And like, the
it's just my hood, so it's where I live. So. Yeah. and it was just magical. And then I wanted to get a double-decker old bus down to Leatherhead. We had it at Beaverbrook down in Leatherhead. My husband's like, "Well, you want to go? You want to be on the A3 going 20 miles an hour in one of those buses?"
Yeah,
take us like 3 hours to get there. Yeah. I was like, "Okay, fine." So we got all these like vetoes down there, and it was really magical. It was gorgeous. But then we had the big wedding at the Gherkin,
Yeah,
which it was like It was amazing. It was like glass, all glass. And it was like I was in heaven because it was all the glass. And it was one of those skies where you can really see the definition of the clouds. It wasn't like powdery clouds. It was like kind of a bit, not stormy, but just like perfect. Like it's like Instagram magic. Filter. And I was thinking, oh my God, is this what? And everyone was dressed in white.
You wore Westwood, white. Right?
Westwood at the first. And then I can't remember at the second, Australian designer. And I thought, oh my God, is this what heaven's like? Up in the clouds, everyone in white.
I mean, you looked so beautiful. You had that natural hair,
didn't
you?
Yeah.
Shorter, kind of bobbed.
Big hair. COVID hair.
COVID, but it looked so gorgeous.
COVID hair,
and a Westwood mini.
It was Westwood, and then I changed. Yeah, because I thought I had the Westwood, and then it was like short and then back, long at the back.
I mean, it was like...
It was amazing. Yeah, also that thing about too old this, too old to that. There's no too old. So you might not play for like Liverpool at 52, but this too old narrative as well. We think we're doing the young ones a disservice because it's like too old for what? I've just started doing a degree at this age, got married at however old I was then. It's not about too old. There's plenty of time. If you're breathing, you've still got time.
How's marriage second time round?
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely. It was good the first time. I was a child.
I just think you're better at relationships when you're older, right? You kind of a bit more compromising, forgiving, understanding of yourself when you're part in it.
Yeah, less forgiving, less storming off. I just used to storm off a lot. Do you know? I actually did that at the beginning of my second, but storm off with the old suitcase with nothing in it.
Wow, how dramatic.
I know. That was before we were married. I was like, do you know what then? Fine. Do you know what? And then I'd leave. And then I said, do you want me to leave? And he said, no. And then one day my friend Gary, I said, yeah. And I left. And my friend went, oh God, you're not still doing that, are you? And I've never done it again.
Really embarrassing. People know that that is a trademark of yours.
The shame.
That is time to go. I need to stop doing this. This is not a good vibe.
The shame. The shame.
What do you think now?
I thought it was good for dramatic effect, but they're not.
Empty suitcase. How funny. It's like, you know, when children run away from home.
Yeah.
And they get to the end of the garden and they're like, where is everything?
Yeah. Why aren't you following me?
I've only got a penguin
You'll
bar
be back.
To keep me going.
You'll be back tomorrow doing the walk of shame with your suitcase. Yeah.
What now at 52 do you think when you look in the mirror? What do you see?
More concealer. That's what I think when I look in the mirror.
You need more or you're wearing more?
No, I need more.
You need
more? Need more concealer. That's what I think. More concealer and it's time to redo your roots. Because there's nothing, you know, I like 52 and there's nothing wrong with grey hair, but it's not for me.
Yeah, okay.
It's not for me. Mm-hmm. It's not for me. I'm not there yet.
You're a brunette.
I mean, I'm grey.
But you feel yourself
gray,
with dark hair.
But... I'm just not ready.
Fair.
I'm just not ready. Can't do it. But, you know, more power to everyone who has grey hair.
Yeah.
You know, over lockdown, everyone's like, 3 months, no colour.
People should do what they want.
They should do what they want.
Yeah.
And that's why I dye my hair black.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely. Lorraine Pascal, thank you so much. Such a pleasure to have you here. You've been a joy, as you always are.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this conversation with Lorraine, do go back into the archives. Lots of other episodes and plenty more to come. In the meantime, thanks for listening and I'll see you next time. Beyond the Bathroom is written and hosted by me, Sally Hughes, and is an Insanity Studios production. The head of production is Charlotte Mason, the head of digital is Ed Buckley, and the production assistant is Abby Sandler.